Amen. Thank you so much, Josh and Emmy and Chris, musicians, for leading. Happy Easter. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. If you've closed your Bible, do open it again. We're going to be in John chapter 11, which isn't your sort of normal reading for Easter Sunday, but it's actually the perfect one. 1961, a book was published under the name, the author's name, N.W. Clarke, but it was a pseudonym. The author's real name actually wasn't revealed until after he died a couple of years later. Here's how the book begins. No one ever told me that grief felt so much like fear. I am not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There's a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be around me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me. There are moments, most unexpectedly, when something inside me tries to assure me that I don't really mind so much. Not so very much, after all. Love is not the whole of a man's life. I was happy before I ever met her. I've plenty of what are called resources. People get over these things. Come on, I shan't do so badly. One is ashamed to listen to this voice, but it seems for a little while to be making out a good case. And then comes a sudden jab of red-hot memory, and all this common sense vanishes like an ant in the mouth of a furnace. Meanwhile, where is God? Not that I'm in much danger of ceasing to believe in God, he writes. The real danger is coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion of I dread is not so there's no God after all, but so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourself no longer. Now, the title of that book is A Grief Observed, and the author's real name was Clive Staples Lewis, Jack Lewis. The love of his life was his wife, Joy, and she had died of cancer at the age of 45. We're on a journey at the moment in King's Church through the book of John, and we're calling it Come and See. You can see it there at the foot of that slide. Come and see. But that's a phrase that's used in this book several times. And it's an invitation. Come and see Jesus. See what he's really like. He will surprise you. He will amaze you. He may transform you. John's gospel has recorded several miracles. Not lots of them, but several carefully chosen ones. And John doesn't call them miracles. He calls them signs. Signs. Like a signpost. He's shown us Jesus changing water into wine. He's shown Jesus healing an official's son at a distance. He's shown him healing a paralyzed man at a pool, feeding 5,000 people with a packed lunch, healing a man born blind. Now, the thing about signs is they're all pointing to something and giving us information we need about the direction of travel. These signs are all telling us information about Jesus Christ. And today we come to the sixth sign, and it is a climax, a high point, a crescendo, and we find that it is all about death. And as you know, this is a topic that most people in our culture would rather not talk about. We're quite happy talking about all sorts of things that people in previous generations would have blushed to say, but we don't want to talk about death. We're in denial about it. Although death is not far from any one of us, we try and avoid it. Death is kept out of sight, behind a curtain, shielded from view. And death, you know, raises the big questions for us, questions that we can't afford to ignore. Where is God in our suffering and death? When we lose people, or when we die ourselves, where is God? And is God going to do anything about it? Now, this is so important because it's coming to all of us. Death is our greatest enemy, and it's an enemy we all share. No matter how strong you are, how powerful, how successful, how intelligent or well-prepared you are, Death will take it all away in an instant, and it is the great unknown. What lies beyond the other side of the veil? Shakespeare's Hamlet pondered it in some famous words. He called it the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns. Puzzles the will, and it makes us rather bear the ills we have than fly to others we know not of. We need to know what's on the other side to prepare us to meet death, whether our own or someone else's. And perhaps there's no more important task in our lives to be prepared for death, and it's the one task that our culture gives us no help with. We are resourceless. So I think there's nothing more important this morning for us to think together about death, because to quote the great Sufjan Stevens, we're all going to die. And John 11 records the most powerful and the greatest sign that Jesus Christ has yet done. A sign points to something other than itself. If the sign says 4 miles to Kingston, you know that if you go for 4 miles in that direction, you're going to find Kingston. And what these signs are doing is saying 4 miles to where the king is. Jesus, follow that way, you'll find him. And this sign shows us what Jesus is really all about, and it gives us the resources to deal with death, our own and that of loved ones. It gives us the resources to deal with suffering that are found nowhere else. So that's why I say it's the most important thing we could be thinking about today. And I've got three very simple headings from this passage. Jesus waits. Jesus weeps. Jesus wins. He waits. He weeps, he wins. Now, the story so far in John, Jesus has been teaching. There's been controversy. There have been death threats made against him. He's a wanted man. He's gone and back across to the River Jordan to base camp. He's teaching again. Many people believe it's a fruitful time in his ministry. But meanwhile, back in a little town called Bethany, a crisis is unfolding. A quiet family tragedy. Now, Jesus knew a lot of people, but there are very few who are described as his friends. And there are three siblings who were particularly close to him: Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. But Lazarus is really ill. So much so that the sisters actually send a message. Maybe we could think of it as a telegram. Verse 3, so the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is ill. Now, that's a kind of read between the lines message, isn't it? This is not just letting Jesus know that Lazarus has a nasty cough. This is a desperate cry for help. The one you love is ill, your close friend, Lord. These two sisters are watching their brother die. And they're agonizing about it, and they've called the doctor enough times, and now they know they've got no hope left except Jesus. He is their last resort. And they know him. They know all about the healings that he's done. Everybody knows about it. Verse 37, actually, everybody says, if you turn over the page, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Everybody knows. Jesus healed a lot of people who aren't even written down in this book. They know that he's got the power to heal Lazarus. They really do. So, what do you think Jesus should do? What would you expect? I would expect him to run there as quickly as he could and heal the guy. He has the means, the motive, and the opportunity. He's got the means, divine power, and a proven track record. He's got the motive, one of his dearest friends. He's got the opportunity. He hears the news while Lazarus is still alive. Could get there in time. So what do you make of verse 5 and 6? Just look at that. If you haven't got a Bible, I'll read it out to you. Verse 5 and 6. Actually, I'm going to read from verse 4. When he heard this, Jesus said, this illness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Oh. You see the logic in that? We might have to just pause there and think about this. He loved them. He really loved them. So when he heard about it, he waited where he was for 2 more days. Because he loved them, he waited. This is so important for us to get today, by the way. Because all these things in the Bible, they're not just from the past, you know. This is a living word. It speaks to you right now today. Because if you're suffering, you're probably experiencing his delay. And it's because he loves you. Jesus loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, and so he waited two more days. He deliberately waits until Lazarus is well and truly dead. In fact, by the time he gets there, the body is known to be decomposing. It is a deliberate delay, and according to these verses in the Bible, it is a delay of love. Now, from our perspective, down where we are living, most of us not much more than 6 foot off the ground, it sometimes appears that God does not care about us anymore. At times, humanly speaking, our circumstances look like they can only admit one interpretation. God really doesn't care about me. Should we be honest here? There are times when it's very difficult to believe, keep on believing in the goodness of God. Maybe for some of you here, that is the reason you don't believe. Well, that's the reason you're holding out. How can it be powerful and good and loving when this happens? According to the Bible, God knows you inside out. He knows everything about you. It says in one place, he knows, if God knows when a sparrow falls to the ground, and he knows every hair on your head, he knows you and he loves you. So, you know, we will never comprehend the mind of God, will we? How could we? How could we grasp all the workings of God in their immensity? The one who holds the entire universe in its being. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are beyond our finding out. And we learn this strange lesson in this text. Jesus waits. He deliberately delayed coming to his friends for their sake, because he loved them. And in verses 14 and 15, we get a little bit more insight into this, if you want to look down the page. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. How interesting. He's dead, and I did it for your sake so that you may believe. Jesus Christ here harnesses suffering of the most painful kind as an opportunity for his friends to learn and grow into their and mature into their full humanity, and which they would never have done if God had spared them all the trouble and pain. And it is the same for you and me. It is the same for you and me. This whole painful episode is a lesson for us. Jesus Christ harnesses the power of suffering in our lives, somehow in his immense wisdom, and helps us to learn and grow into full maturity, to believe in him. Now, when a child is struggling, and some of you are parents here, you know, I'm standing here next to a box full of chocolate eggs. And you may, a very young child would want to gorge themselves, wouldn't they, on as many eggs as they could get their hands on. Me and my wife have had these eggs in our house for 2 weeks. One night, we ate 3 cream eggs each. Tell you what, by the end of the third one, it was getting a bit rich. But you know some kids who will go way beyond 3. Some of them live in my house. There are times when, as a parent, you have to say to a young child, no, 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 stop now. And the child, the egg is the most beautiful and sweet thing in my life. Why are you keeping it from me? Give it to me. The parent knows better. Now, that's a very, very simple kind of illustration. But you know, if your parents, you get older, you see your kids. Somebody said to me once, I think the older they get, the more your kids need you, but the less say you have in the matter. There are things you want to stop them from doing, but you think, I'm going to let them do it because I want them to learn and grow through this situation. Now, that's us as human, just frail human people. We know that through experience, people grow. What about God, the maker of heaven and earth? Doesn't he know better? There's a reason why he waits. So is there someone here who needs this medicine now? How's your heart? How's your spiritual health? How are your loved ones? Who is your Lazarus at this present time? Who is your Lazarus? The two sisters sent word to Jesus, and then they watched their brother die. They must have been out on the road looking to see if Jesus was coming every 10 minutes, don't you think? Where is he? And as Lazarus gets paler and paler and sicker, the clock is ticking and the realization dawns on them, he's not here. Where's Jesus? No sign of him. And his terrible phrase, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. Oh, if only. Yet we know, don't we, oh gentle readers, we know that it was a deliberate delay, a delay of love. Because he loved them, he waited. Jesus waited for a reason. Friends, he still does. He still does. I don't know the reason. You might not know it for a long time, but he knows. He waits. Secondly, he weeps. The second vital thing that we learn from this sign is the reaction of Jesus to suffering and grief. John 11, verse 35, maybe the shortest verse in the Bible. You know what? We've got a memory verse on that sheet for the kids, but I just realized we could have given this memory verse and everyone could remember it. John 11, verse 35, Jesus wept. Two words. Jesus wept. A very simple detail, but one that we mustn't overlook because it's teaching something very, very important about God here, which we need to know and we need to hold on to it. It's the nature of our God's response to our suffering. When he sees our extremity, how does he feel about it? How does he respond? Is he cold and distant? Is he cruel and sadistic? Hard-hearted? You see, you deserved it. Is he a punishing father? Or is he something else? John 11 gives us the most intimate window into the emotional life of our Lord that we have. We must consider this and hold it dear. Jesus wept. Notice four things here. Jesus calms, he listens, he grieves, and he rages. Rages. He comes at great personal cost and risk. Remember, he's got death threats on him. Jesus makes this journey across to Bethany. He comes to them. He shows up. He arrives. And then he listens. Now look, both of the sisters basically say something, which is, I don't know if it's unfair to say it's passive aggressive. Look at verse 21. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. That's Martha. Verse 32. Mary reached the place. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. They're telling him that if he'd been there, the brother wouldn't have died. And what does Jesus say? He listens. Just listens to them. They pour out their misery to him. And frankly, I think it's reproachful. If you had been here, does he argue back? He's not defensive. He listens patiently. He calms and listens. And then he grieves. Verses 33 to 35. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. And then the Jews said, see how he loved him? He weeps. In other words, he feels their sorrow. By the way, notice this. He weeps even though he knows he's going to raise him from the dead in about 2 minutes. Right? He's not weeping because he's lost Lazarus forever. He's not weeping for his own grief here, is he? Because he knows he's about to raise him from the dead. This is a different kind of weeping. He's weeping in sympathy with them. He feels their sorrow and he enters into it, or we might say it enters into him, and he is stirred to the depths of his being, even though he knows what he's about to do for Lazarus. Jesus comes, listens, and grieves with them. He feels it, but then he rages. And you say, where's that? Verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Now, the word that's underneath here, this word in the original language, is a word that means indignant, angry, agitated, deeply moved, vehement. He is furious. He rages at all the brokenness and misery and sorrow of death and what it does to us. And he rages at the devil who holds the power of death. Over 100 years ago, there was a great theologian in America, in Princeton University, Benjamin Warfield. Here's what he wrote. Listen to this. Why did the sight of the wailing of Mary and her companions enrage Jesus? Because it brought poignantly home to his consciousness the evil of death, its unnaturalness, its violent tyranny. In Mary's grief, Jesus contemplates the general misery of the whole human race. And he burns with rage against the oppressor of men. Inextinguishable fury seizes upon him. His whole being is discomposed and perturbed, and his heart cries out. It is death that is the object of his wrath, and behind death, him who holds the power of death and who has come to the world to destroy. Tears of sympathy may fill his eyes, but this is incidental. His soul is held by rage, and he advances to the tomb as a champion who prepares for conflict. Jesus isn't going up there, oh. The raising of Lazarus thus becomes an instance and an open symbol of Jesus' conquest of death and hell. What John is doing here is uncovering to us the heart of Jesus as he wins our salvation for us. Not in cold unconcern, but in flaming wrath against the foe, Jesus smites in our behalf. He has not only saved us from the evils which oppress us, he has felt for us and he has felt with us in our oppression. And under the impulse of these feelings, he has wrought out our redemption. Let me ask you, Christian brother or sister, to listen to this. Behold your God. As he moves towards a tomb to defeat it. This is your God, who we remember this Easter day. He comes down, he makes the journey all the way down from heaven to earth to a stable. From being a prince to being a slave. From life to death himself on a cross. He comes all the way down. He comes. He listens patiently as you pour out your heart to him. The middle of the Bible is a book of songs. It's got 150 poems in it. It's called the Psalms. A half of them are lamenting. Half of them are just crying out and saying, oh Lord, how long? I'm so miserable. Half of them. He listens. He doesn't insist that you suffer in silence. He wants to hear you sing about it. Your God also weeps. He is grieved when you grieve. And he rages. He doesn't wring his hands in helpless empathy. He moves toward the grave with strong purpose. So let me ask again, friend, today, what are you doing with your misery? Right now, you have a choice. You can choose which perspective to view your pain through. You can weep on your own. You can turn your heart away, or you can come to Jesus Christ, knowing what he's like, because he's like this. The door is not locked against you and bolted from the inside. He is waiting for you. Go to him now. He weeps with you, and he knows your pain. But having waited and having wept, there is a third one here, which is that Jesus wins. He wins. Right at the heart of this passage is a really extraordinary conversation between Jesus and one of his friends, Martha. If you want to look at it with me, it's on verse 21 to 24. And this is like a theological chat that happens right in the middle of all the drama. And it's very revealing. Verse 21, Martha says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask. What is she saying there? Is there a hint of reproach? But is there some faith? Just reaching out, grasping for something. I know that even now, something could happen. And then in verse 23, Jesus says, your brother will rise again. That is a true and orthodox statement. Most Jewish believers believed it. They believed it from their Bible, the three quarters of this book that we call the Old Testament. And Martha hears Jesus say, your brother will rise again. And she replies, again, this is a theological chat, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. You see, standard Jewish belief was that there would be a resurrection from the dead at the end of history. One day when God would raise all people from the dead in one go, and then there would be a judgment. So the whole conception of the resurrection is that it is future. It's a future event for everybody. And there is no conception at all that there could be one person raised from the dead in the middle of history. There's no idea about that. So when Jesus hears, Martha hears Jesus say, she says, yeah, I know he will rise again at the resurrection at the last day. She's basically saying, Lord, I know he'll rise again, but that's not really helping me now, is it? Now that I'm hurting. And so Jesus says these dramatic words, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Annie Leggett, children's talk. Your heart will stop beating, but your spiritual heart will never die. And then he says to Martha, do you believe this? Do you believe this? The resurrection, in other words, is not a concept. It's a person. This is the sixth time Jesus says, I am. In John's gospel, he says, I am the light of the world. I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection and the life. What does that mean? Jesus himself embodies in himself the resurrection of the dead. And he causes it. He's the one that will make the resurrection of the dead happen. There won't be any rising from the dead unless Jesus makes it happen. But there will be in his power. So if you believe in, trust in, follow in Jesus Christ, he actually makes the guarantee that you will live even though you die. In other words, Jesus here is claiming to be the one who deals with death, our greatest enemy. And that's entirely consistent with everything we've learned about him so far in this marvelous book. We learned right at the beginning that Jesus, that in the beginning, before the world was made, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This Word was with God in the beginning. This Word is then revealed to us as somebody who's become a man and lived in our world, Jesus Christ. It says that he's the one who made all things. Nothing that has been made was made without him. Jesus is the agent of creation. It says that Jesus is the one with the most intimate relationship with God, the Father. No one has ever seen God, it says, but God, the only begotten Son, has made him known. The one who lived in the bosom of the Father, the intimacy with the Father. He's the light of the world who turns back the darkness. And now he says, I am the resurrection and the life. So friends, the night may be very dark and long, and your tears may be very bitter indeed. But this text gives us strong assurance Jesus wins. He will win. He's the resurrection and the life. He will defeat death. He is the victor. And so at that moment in history, he goes to the grave and he commands them, roll that stone away. Nobody wanted to do that. It's grim. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days, and it's a hot country. I'm not going to go into detail. There are children present. They all know by now what's going on with the body. And those caves that they use for tombs, they could sometimes hold 8 people. You really don't want to take that stone away, do you? Goodness knows. But such is Jesus' authority that they just shut up and did it. And he steps towards the door of the tomb and he commands, Lazarus, come out. And stumbling out, still wrapped in his grave clothes, possibly with a cloth on his face, maybe looking like the mummy, becomes Lazarus. But he isn't, what they call it, zombie apocalypse. His body is completely restored to health and strength. They can take off the cloths, and Lazarus is in the best health he's ever been in. Life has returned at the word of Jesus Christ. Lazarus, friend of Jesus, who got to be the guest at his own funeral. Only now the funeral is turned into a party. That's some wake, wasn't it? Jesus wins. He has power over death. No other religious leaders really claim this kind of power for themselves. Our final enemy has been defeated, and we anticipate the resurrection of the dead. Christian brother and sister, you live in sure and certain hope of the resurrection because of Christ. Now that is lovely for Lazarus and Mary and Martha. How does this connect with you and me this week? Last year in November, the Sunday Times published an article by a journalist called Dominic Lawson, titled, "Who Wants to Live Forever? I Wouldn't Mind." And the article was prompted by the news that Cambridge University, funded by some tech billionaires, has set up an institute for technology and humanity dedicated to exploring attempts to prolong human life, maybe indefinitely. What would happen? You know, if you put them in a cryo freezer, what happens 100 years later? Who wants to live forever? And Dominic Lawson replies, "I do. I do. Like all humans," he wrote, "I take this personally. The idea of being dead petrifies me. I know this is usually expressed as fear of dying, but it's not the process that bothers me. We can be said to be dying from the moment of our birth. It's the outcome that fills me with dread. Non-existence." Now, some people have offered consolation. At least you live on in the memory of those who loved you. Perhaps you live on in the legacy that you leave. But I think Woody Allen was right. "I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment." Really alive. And this is where reality bites here. Jesus Christ did not just defy death. He didn't just deny death, he destroyed death. He has the power to raise Lazarus himself, and when Jesus Christ himself died and rose on the third day, he literally, bodily rose from the dead, defeating our greatest enemy. And he promised to do the same for all his followers. This is what we remember today, Easter Day. Of all the days in the calendar, we remember exactly how Jesus has conquered death, by dying himself and rising. See, we're all going to die, and we all deserve to. We've all lived in rejection of God and his love. We've turned from him, the source of life, but Jesus dies in our place. He did not die for his own sins. He was absolutely pure. He died for his people, every one of them, as their head, their representative. He dies the death that was due to you and me. And in his death, he paid all our debts and took our shame upon himself. And on the third day, he rose to new life, never to die again, which means you can too. You see, Jesus has not just come from heaven to earth. He's also come from the future into the present. He shows us what the future's going to be like. When he says, "I am the resurrection and the life," he's announcing the future verdict that God will make on death. Death will end. And it will be no more. The future has burst into the present. Mary and Martha saw on a little local scale what God will one day do for all his people, reversing decay, recreating life, bringing back the body in all its fullness and joy, and bringing light. That's the future. But at the moment, we live in the middle of the Bible. Paul Mallard is a pastor, he's a writer, and he loved his wife, Edgery, they were childhood sweethearts, actually, met at school, and he's head over heels for her, and they married, and they had four children. She was 7 months pregnant with their fourth child, and she was having a really rough time, and it was something worse than just morning sickness and pregnancy issues. It got really bad. Her speech was slurring. She had trouble walking or even standing up, and she was 7 months pregnant. They went to hospital. They were referred to the neurologist. And then the grimmest moment, Paul said, was when the neurologist asked to speak to me on my own. It was not normal to talk to the partner like this, but my wife was very fragile. And the neurologist suspected she had a serious condition, perhaps multiple sclerosis. It was not usually life-threatening, but the complications of the pregnancy and the intensity of the symptoms made it very dangerous. And here's the thing, she never got better. She never got better. Paul became her carer from that day on. Now, decades later, he wrote these words. Let me read them to you. We live in the middle of the Bible. We've got to come to recognize the sheer magnitude and awful intensity of pain that exists in the world. We're surrounded by pain, and the only condition for suffering it is to live long enough to experience it. Suffering is one of the most consistent themes of the Bible. We live in a fallen, broken, bleeding world. I once prepared a series of sermons on suffering, and the thing that struck me most was the fact that suffering is an underlying assumption throughout the Bible. If you take out the first two chapters and the last two chapters of Revelation, suffering and pain is the common theme of everything in between. The human race comes from a pain-free zone where everything was very good, and we're heading for a pain-free zone where the curse of sin and its consequences will be gone forever, and all things will be made new. But we're not there yet. We live in the middle of the book, a place marked by tears and death, mourning and pain. Any Christian teaching that wants to take us away from that experience of pain and settle us into a kind of pre-heaven bliss is unbalanced and unhelpful and, frankly, downright wrong. We need a good dose of biblical realism. Human beings are born for trouble as surely as sparks fly upwards. So we live in the middle of the book, okay? We're not doing happy-clappy. You know what you call a happy-clappy Baptist? A happy-clappy Bappy. We're not just doing silly songs today and ha-ha-ha and give out eggs and forget about real life. This is in the middle of tears. This is in the middle of tears. And here's the thing, we have a choice now about how we can live. We can follow Martha's example. We can choose to trust Christ in the midst of misery, and we will see his glory there in a way that we will never see anywhere else. Because he loved them, he waited. When he came, he wept. And he went to the tomb, and he won. His delays are the delays of love. His silence is the silence of love. He wants you to ask the big questions, to pour out your heart to him. He cares so much, he enters your sorrow. But ultimately, Jesus Christ wins. Amen. Let's pray. Lord, I want to pray for those people here for whom this has been a hard morning. It's not been easy and glib. I want to pray for people here who have a Lazarus in their life, or have lost someone, or feeling it right now, and there is no easy answer for them. And we're not going to offer them a shallow comfort, but we're going to offer them the only comfort and the deepest comfort that your word affords and that this world affords, which is that you give them yourself. You delayed so that they might believe and put their trust in you. Lord, help each one here to do that today. I pray in your strong name. Amen.